By the numbers, conservative politicians hold great power in the United States today. The presidency, House of Representatives, and Senate all have more Republicans than Democrats, so there's conservative control there. The U.S. Supreme Court has more conservatives than liberals. At the state level, two-thirds of partisan legislative bodies are controlled by Republicans, 67 of 98. What leads to this level of dominance? Winning elections, sure, but are the ideas that good or the money that abundant? These are the kinds of issues raised by Nancy McLean in her book Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean is a professor of history and public policy at Duke University in North Carolina. Her previous books are Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. Nancy McLean, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So this is a hard-hitting book, right, from the title. I mean, Democracy in Chains and the Radical Right, just mentioned in the title and subtitle alone. But you back this up with a lot of research.
Yes, I do. And I didn't set out to write the book that I was writing. I was working on another book when I picked up this trail. And I just could see as the years went on and I got deeper and deeper in that this was just something so new and so shocking that I wanted to alert people to it. And that's why I chose the kind of title that I did.
So, you know, people might assume that this is a book about the Koch brothers. They certainly get mentioned in here a lot. But the real focus is on a guy by the name of James McGill Buchanan. Not the President Buchanan. Mm-hmm. Who was this James McGill Buchanan?
Yeah, I think that's important for people to know, too, because Charles Koch was investing for years, literally for decades, before he began to have effect. I mean, a lot of things just went nowhere because these are minority ideas, a minority vision that he espouses, and he was not able to get the results that he wanted until he began investing in James Buchanan's ideas and his center at George Mason University in the late 1990s. And since then, it's been a very different phenomenon. So the money is important, but without the ideas, we would not be seeing the kind of radical transformation we're seeing now. And I also want to point out, it's interesting, you know, now many people who are affiliated with this cause go under the fly under the flag of conservatism, and they call themselves conservative. But in their earlier years, they were much more honest. Charles Koch and James Buchanan and, you know, the other thinkers that Charles Koch supported, like Hayek, none of them accepted the label conservative. They understood themselves as radicals and radicals of the right. And it's really become a label of convenience in order to reach out to the large mass base on the right and in the Republican Party that they've chosen conservative. But I think if many people who understand themselves as conservatives and as Republicans were to become familiar with these ideas and where these guys are going, I think that they would be really surprised and not on board. So perhaps we'll come back to that. But James McGill Buchanan is not a household name. I didn't even know of his name when I happened upon him in the archives doing another kind of research project. But I learned that he was one of the most original thinkers about democracy in America's history. Sadly, he didn't like it and had much criticism of it, but he was certainly an original thinker. He developed a new school of political economy that he often called the Virginia School of Political Economy. Sometimes people summarize it as public choice economics because it focuses on decisions made in the public sector as opposed to in the market. It focuses on the actions of political actors, whether they be social movement actors or elected officials, and it's really the set of ideas that I think is shaping the 21st century, the early 21st century, much as the ideas of the Chicago School of Milton Friedman shaped the late 20th century.
You described the thoughts and ideas of James McGill Buchanan and the Koch brothers as minority ideas and a minority vision. Did you think McGill certainly Buchanan rather accepted that? I mean, if he called himself a radical, or at least his peers
right.
did.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And one of the things that was most arresting to me as I was working through the sources is that by the late 1970s, all of these guys, and this goes beyond Buchanan and includes other people in what was called the Mont Pelerin Society, which is this international invitation-only organization that included many of the leading free market economists along with business people and right-wing foundations, started in 1947. But by the late 1970s, they pretty much all accepted that they were never going to persuade a majority, and they say that in their meetings and in their documents. They say that, and so, and they actually, one of them, George Stiglitz, said in the late 1970s, so if what we want is not what others want, should we be thinking about how to shape institutions to better reflect what we want, even if it means becoming non-democratic? So, I mean, that's the kind of language that you find in the sources when you do the archival research on this. So they were very clear about it. Buchanan was very clear that he was standing up for minority rights. Koch has made very clear that he's acting as someone who knows he'll always be part of a minority. And I think that's really chilling because, you know, if you pause for a moment and think, the U.S. Constitution was drafted and created by people who wanted to see a government run by the people, right? It says we the people. And they wanted the majority to govern, but they also wanted to have protections for minority rights. You know, so those protections are already there. We have the most restrictive constitution in the modern world, more veto points than anybody else. But for these property rights supremacists like Buchanan and like Charles Koch, the protections that we have for minority rights, and here you can translate that for them to be minority of the wealthy or corporations, those protections are inadequate, are checks and balances. So they want to go beyond checks and balances to effectively locks and bolts that will keep the majority from being able to use the government for common purposes that require tax revenues.
So was it more about keeping government small or keeping markets free, or do you get both by doing one?
Well, they would say keeping government small keeps markets free, but I think there's something really important to pay attention to here, which is for all the talk of small government, these guys are really not interested in a light-touch government. If you look at what they're doing at the state level in states like mine in North Carolina and much of the South and many parts of the country as well, they're using state government power in a very aggressive way to prevent localities from being able to do what their people want, whether it is raising minimum wages or stopping discrimination.
Okay, so some centralization
of power.
We'll come back and talk more with Nancy McLean about Democracy in Chains on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today to Nancy McLean, who's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. She's written a hard-hitting book called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She's already told us this was not the book she intended to write. She was working on something else when she found more and more details about an economist named James McGill Buchanan, who lived for many years in Virginia, died just a few years ago, and was the source of many ideas that the Koch brothers picked up and funded and have turned into large-scale Republican and conservative control of much of the political apparatus in the country. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the story begins with desegregation in the wake of the Brown versus Board of Education and similar Supreme Court decisions in the mid-50s. I want to be as fair as possible to James McGill Buchanan and the others. I mean, were they threatened by having schools filled with black people or poor people, or what was the issue there?
I don't think that Buchanan would have talked about it in those terms. I certainly never saw him saying anything in the public record along those lines. But he was someone who had grown up in Tennessee, self-styled Tennessee country boy. He took great pride in that, styled himself a kind of populist. And he went off to the University of Chicago and got his doctorate in economics just after the war. He had served in the Navy during World War II. So he came back with these Chicago-style ideas that said, you know, essentially government is bad, the market is good. And he got a job in Virginia in 1956, just as the state government was goading really the white South to massive resistance to the Brown decision as an illegitimate extension of federal power. And so Buchanan responded to it in those terms. I will say he had an inherited or a willful blindness to what was happening to black citizens and to the injustices to them and the fact that they had no liberty whatsoever in the Virginia of his day. But he certainly did not seem obsessed with that. Rather, he and Milton Friedman and many of these early libertarians who got involved in the late 1950s and were supporting what Virginia's government was doing, they seemed to get involved because they saw it as an opportunity for their project of what they would called it the free society. And what they meant by that was essentially getting rid of the public sector. So much of what we value, many of us value in the public sector, whether it's public schools or Social Security, things like that, they were opposed to these. And so when they saw the state of Virginia threatening to shut down any public school that desegregated and to divert public tax monies to private schools that could segregate and would be beyond the reach of the Brown decision, Buchanan supported that, as did Milton Friedman. And I was just stunned to find this in the archives and in the sources and to realize that nobody had really commented on this before or tried to make sense of this. And it was in trying to make sense of what he was doing in Virginia at the time, you know, how somebody could be so committed to what they called liberty and the free society and not understand that they were abetting the people who were taking away the freedoms of others, you know, on a daily basis. Trying to understand that, I became more intrigued with Buchanan and then started to follow his writings and his story through the years. And lo and behold, they led me to Charles Koch and his donor network.
And so, I mean, are we correct in saying that Charles Koch and his donor network really helped sell the ideas and spread them a lot more widely than Buchanan might have been able to do on his own or with his own friends?
Yes, and I would say, too, this is not just about selling ideas, because Koch's network also does sell some ideas. You know, they recruit young people around the country. They provide a tremendous amount of grant support and fellowship support, and they bring people in with much sunnier work, you could say, you know, like Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom, Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, a lot of works that talk about liberty in very positive ways. But what they've done with Buchanan, as near as I can tell, is make him kind of the advanced course. You know, once you recruit people with those other works, then you go to Buchanan's ideas to understand how you have to transform institutions and rewrite the rules in order to achieve this vision that you've been converted to. And so Buchanan's work is much darker. It's kind of like the yin and yang. You know, he and Friedman were kind of the yin and yang. And Buchanan's work is much more about undercutting the public sector, about restricting democratic majorities, about, you know, making it impossible to act on things like climate change. You know, when I was listening, waiting for the show to talk, you were talking about some of the crazy weather that you're experiencing in Oregon. And it's really important to realize that this donor network has used Buchanan's ideas in order to change the discussion on the environment and on global warming. And just to give you one index of that, in 1991, there was almost no difference between the two major parties on the science of what's happening to the planet, only on, you know, what would be the best means to address it. By 2014, only 8 of 278 Republicans in Congress were willing to acknowledge that man-made climate change was a reality. Now, what changed to make that result? That is the application of Buchanan's thought about incentives and penalties, and particularly the way that the Koch donors network has raised huge amounts of money to run primary challenges against any Republican officeholder who doesn't toe the donors line on these things. And so effectively what they're getting is, and they actually, one of the top Koch operatives called it the secret sauce, that this is their secret sauce. He called it the accountability play, where instead of Republican elected officials answering to their own voters who also want to take action on some of these things, they're answering to the donors who want to stop it in its tracks.
Nancy McLean from Duke University is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Can you give us a short list now? We can potentially lengthen this later, of examples of bills and laws in the last decade or two that you can trace directly back to James McGill Buchanan?
Yes, happy to, or unhappy as the case may be. The efforts that we've seen toward voter suppression, that comes from Buchanan's thought. He believed that too many people were voting. He actually thought that anyone who worked for the government should, it was wrong for them to have the right to vote. You know, whether you're a public school teacher or a hospital nurse or a elected official, you shouldn't have the right to vote about government because you might support more government spending out of your self-interest. He was always uncomfortable with the expansion of the franchise, you know, as he watched it unfolding in Virginia. So voter suppression would be one. Gerrymandering is another. There were actually people at his center at George Mason who were working with state officials to recommend, to think about how you could follow through the sources the kinds of policy proclivities of voters in a way that would help you to shape districts that would get you what you wanted. That would be another. There's something called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights that's being pushed in a number of states. Kansas, the Republicans in the state legislature actually defied the governor to
overrode
get rid of it
his veto,
it's been so devastating for their state. But they've pushed that measure in a number of places. And again, that's in that locks and bolts mode, you know, as opposed to checks and balances. They would like to see a balanced budget amendment for America, and they're actually organizing toward a constitutional convention to get that, among other what they would call liberty amendments. We could just go on. Oh, let me think. Some of the other things that are happening in the courts and in the law, not necessarily right to work legislation, totally comes from these people. And that cause was there before, but you can see the Buchanan imprint in some of the changes in recent years. So, for example, when Scott Walker in Wisconsin, famously in 2011, took away collective bargaining rights from public sector workers there. They were not only doing a kind of right to work, but they actually put in new rules to make it nearly impossible for unions to continue. So it included things like they had to be annually – first of all, they were not allowed to bargain over essentially anything that you would want to bargain over, right? So their purview was really limited. But then they were subject to annual recertification, which would mean you spent all your time organizing to get back on the ballot so you couldn't actually serve members or do anything for them. Anyway, I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this, but I just want to say that so many of these really precise rule changes that we've seen in the last few years, whether it's on the right to work front or the voting front or gerrymandering or the way public institutions of higher education are run, all of these are being informed by the school of thought developed by Buchanan.
Our listeners are familiar with the name of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange mm-hmm. Council, which has propagated a lot of these ideas to state legislatures around the country. Does the list from ALEC pretty much compare side by side with the list from James McGill Buchanan?
And I would say, I mean, it's not like he was, you know, sitting in his office concocting precise pieces sure. of legislation in the right way that ALEC does, but his principles, the principles of his approach to undermining the 20th century model of government, those principles are very much built into the ALEC agenda. And also some of the tactics. And you know, a lot of people, I think, if they see stealth in the title, you know, the radical right's stealth plan for America, they might balk at that and think, you know, who is this person? What are they suggesting? But if we look at, say, the case of Social Security, we can see Buchanan's thought in action and the kind of advice he provided to others on the radical right. This was in the early 1980s. It was after the Pinochet junta in Chile privatized Social Security, applying some of Buchanan's ideas and changed their constitution in ways that he recommended. And he came home to the U.S. very eager to see radical change, and he advised the Cato Institute on a strategy for Social Security reform, and he actually put reform in quotation marks as like a wink to say, no, this isn't really about reform. It's about getting rid of this system that we've never liked. But he started from saying, look, there is absolutely no constituency in America today for the kind of changes we want to see. He specified. He said neither old people nor young people, wealthy people, poor people, black or white. He went men or women. He went through the whole list. So he said, essentially, therefore, if we want to see the kind of radical changes that they wanted to see, which is essentially ending Social Security as a principle of social insurance and pushing people into private accounts with the financial sector, which is what happened in Chile, if we want to see that, then we have to think strategically about how to do that. And he laid out about a five-step plan for how to do that that is really quite chilling. And, I mean, I could say more if you want here or it's in the book, but that's what I mean by stealth. You know, really people who are operating from the knowledge that the public does not want what they want and that they're not going to persuade anybody by arguing openly for what it is that they really seek. So instead, coming up with strategy to get from where we are to where they want to be in a way that will just leave the public sort of shocked when it finds that all of this has gone through and it's almost impossible to reverse it.
Nancy McLean is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of history and public policy at Duke University in North Carolina. Her book is called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, a large focus on James McGill Buchanan, an economist who spent many years in Virginia. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. Ideas go to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to take a really broad view because it's easy for people to find boogeymen or so-called puppet masters somewhere in there. You know, Glenn Beck went goes crazy over George Soros.
Right.
For example. I just want to make
sure.
Have you fired a fair number of bullets at your own work here in examining the impact of James McGill Buchanan?
I believe me. I have gone through this again and again and again and subjected it to scrutiny from, you know, very well-informed people in various domains because I don't want to get any of this wrong. I really want it to be accurate. And I myself am uncomfortable with the idea that some people will see this as a conspiracy because actually it's not a conspiracy. In certain ways, frankly, it's worse than a conspiracy because a conspiracy, by the technical and the legal definition, a conspiracy involves illegality. And what we're seeing is something by people who do believe in the rule of law and also who can hire the best attorneys who are scrupulously staying within the law, except perhaps the law on nonprofits, you know, that they should engage in partisan activity.
Right.
That might be one place where there's fudging. But basically, this is operating within the law, but it is a kind of revolution. It's a kind of slow-motion revolution by rules change, and it doesn't need to be a violent revolution because there's so much money. These, you know, the inequality that has skyrocketed in our country over the last few decades has made it such that there is a group of billionaires and multimillionaires who are actually hostile to our form of government, who want to see it changed, and they are, many of them are non-public industries. You know, they're entrepreneurs who built their own things. They don't like being accountable to anybody, and they certainly don't want to be accountable to Democratic majorities. And so they are pushing this agenda for radical change. And it's not a conspiracy. It's, in fact, something that we don't even have the language for because it's so new in history. I mean, I study history. I've studied U.S. history back to the beginning. I've studied the history of other parts of the world. And we are faced with something we don't even have the words for. The closest I came in the book to finding adequate words was to say that it was a fifth column movement, mm-hmm. in the sense that this is a group of people who are deeply hostile to our model of government, who want to see it transformed in a fundamental way and are willing to operate by stealth. But even that, I don't think is adequate. I think we're all going to have to put our heads together once we understand this thing and decide what to call it and what to do about it.
So, Nancy, you just touched on inequality, which obviously emerges as a major issue in the way the economic system, certainly in this country, has changed as the system of government has been modified along with it, or, you know, which begat which, we can argue about. But
yeah.
But is inequality a byproduct or is it the point in the James McGill Buchanan's thinking?
Oh, that's interesting. They have... again, I think this is important to realize. They do have an ethical system, you know, almost a very rigid, you could say, ethical system, but they do have a kind of morality that's important to understand. You know, I don't think that this is just about venal self-interest in reducing taxes or getting free of regulation. I don't think anybody would put effort in like these, especially Charles Koch has, if he didn't believe, you know, to the very core of his being in what he's doing. But he does have a way of looking at the world, and he's said this in his writings and in interviews, where, you know, he believes that people who are brilliant, as he thinks he himself is, and in fact he is, but that people who are brilliant or who work hard rightly deserve all the rewards they get in a market society, and that those who are less effective, including business owners who fail to gauge their market adequately, who don't have good technology, that they deserve to fail. And he uses this very moralistic language, that they deserve to fail. And he actually said at one point that people like that should become a janitor or a worker. And you know, that just took me aback. It's like the notion of being a worker is like a sentence, like a criminal sentence, you know, in his view. You know, when that used to be, you know, we used to, in the mid-20th century, like, respect, right? And even the Bible, you know, we respect people who work and work hard. But in his view, if you're not succeeding economically, you're in effect kind of condemned, and it's your own fault, and you deserve what you get. And Buchanan himself in the 1970s wrote a famous piece called The Samaritan's Dilemma, in which basically he said Jesus was wrong. You shouldn't help other people because you create perverse incentives by doing so. It would be better, and it's just crazy if you think about it in terms of the biblical passage that he's speaking to, but it does tell you something about how these guys think. So I think they would say, yes, that inequality is a necessary result of a freely operating market economy, and we shouldn't do anything about the folks who are on the bottom. And I can say more about that after the break if you want.
Wow, winners and losers deserve to lose, it sounds like. I mean, they just weren't good enough to be winners. Wow.
Yep.
All right, this is Nancy McLean on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. We'll come back and talk more with her and take some phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. The name James McGill Buchanan is not a household word in America, but could certainly become a lot better known if more people read Nancy McLean's book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean, professor of history and public policy at Duke University, says this isn't the book she intended to write, but the more she learned about James McGill Buchanan and the way his ideas had been spread around the country and placed into effect, the idea of separating capitalism from democracy and keeping capitalism safe from democracy, certainly financed by the Koch brothers et al. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Some family history here. James Buchanan's grandfather was the governor of Tennessee. Is that right?
Yes, it's a very interesting story. He was elected as a populist candidate in the 1890s, and he was elected by a coalition of free miners who were beginning to organize in the United Mine Workers, and farmers who were, like all farmers, were, you know, really strapped in the 1890s, and that's why they began organizing the populist movement. And the particular issue in Tennessee was convict labor, that this hated company was using prison convicts, hiring out prison convicts to do the mining that had been done by free workers who were trying to improve their standard of living beyond the miserable level they were at. And the answer to the miners organizing on the part of the company was to hire these convicts. And so this became a huge popular cause in Tennessee, and a big coalition that was part of the People's Party elected a populist governor, Buchanan's grandfather, in order to stop that. That was the key item in the plan. And in the end, he signed sided with the company against the people. And there was a, it was one of the biggest insurrections in the New South, where people of all classes, men and women, professionals and workers and farmers, actually went to the corporate stockades, and they released the prisoners. And in, and many of the prisoners were black, and this is Tennessee, a mostly white state. There was not hostility. There was not racism. They actually gave the convicts clothes so that they could escape, you know, and not be caught, because they were so angry and they understood the corporations were doing this. And Buchanan's, so that was the end of Buchanan's political career. He was one-term governor because he broke his promise to them and they turned on him. But what was really interesting to me in that is he was one of the larger landowners in the state, and he, you know, perhaps felt affinity with the company. He certainly was tight-fisted on spending. You know, he didn't want to raise taxes. He wanted to have a fiscal tight ship, and this selling the convicts was a way that the state got money. So for whatever reason, he broke with his base and went with the companies, and his personal story really influenced his grandson. He was apparently a very bitter man after that, very angry. He went back to the Democratic Party of the time, which supported disenfranchisement of black voters. And, you know, we'll never know what he told his grandson. But his grandson, by his own telling, you know, spent many hours with him and reading in his old pamphlet collection and whatnot. And he developed a form of populism that effectively, like, completely upended the populism of the 1890s. So the populists of the 1890s were, you know, were whatever you want to call it, radicals, left wing. I mean, to them, the parasites were companies like that company that was using convict labor. They were banks that gouged farmers on their mortgages so bad that they lost their farms. They were, you know, sleazy attorneys and such. And the people, the hardworking people, were those to be upholded and control the government. Well, Buchanan kind of flips that script, and in his telling, the makers become, you know, people including these large corporations, and the takers and the parasites become the people who look to government for help, as the populace of the 1890s did. So, you know, it's a kind of a mystery, I think, of psychology and personality that one could do that, but that's what he did.
Well, there is a real sense in this portion of the book where you're writing about the forces that formed James McGill Buchanan, a real sense of how dare they coming from him, and in terms of like how dare those workers gain power by unionizing. Is that ultimately where he came from?
Yes, I think so. And another thing he noticed, too, that's very interesting is the sheriffs. The sheriffs were popularly elected and therefore did not back up his governor, but supported the citizenry of Tennessee, who was really against this convict lease system. And so I think that's another point where Buchanan realized, wow, if people are answerable to voters, they won't do the things that big property holders would want them to. So it is, yeah, it's a very interesting story. And he, you know, he opposed the kind of labor unions that so equalized America in the mid-20th century and inspired hope in so many, including, you know, young civil rights activists who turned to strikes as a way, you know, sit-ins. And there was a high school student strike in Virginia where the students saw that workers were achieving a lot by striking, so they struck for a better high school, and that actually set off the chain of events that leads to Brown versus Board of Education. But yeah, for Buchanan, it's like, you know, how dare you come and ask me to pay taxes to support schooling when my wife and I don't have any children? We don't want to do that. Why should we do that? That's coercion. That's illegitimate. And he really did have a strong sense of personal outrage about some of these things that really comes through in his writings.
Let us take a call. We have Ann and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nancy McLean, the author of Democracy in Chains.
Thank you so much. So I've been watching politics since 1948, and starting in 1964, after the first Civil Rights Act was passed, I've watched the degradation of the Republican Party. And then in 1973, after Roe versus Wade, they went after the right-wing patriarchal religions. And what gets me is the short-sightedness of these billionaires, because if they actually got what they want and have this very unfair society, it would eventually lead to a French-style revolution. So thank you.
Thanks for that, Anne. Appreciate that. Your thoughts on the possibility of that, Nancy?
Yes, I think Anna's absolutely right that in truth, the kind of society that these people would create if they were successful is an absolutely unsustainable society. I mean, we won't even mention the fact that they don't recognize what women do, what mothers do, and daughters do, the care work as being important or worthy of recognition. So if you're home raising your children or taking care of your ailing father and you need support to do that, you're a parasite to them. You know, so this is a really chilling system, and I totally agree with her that the property supremacists have exploited any kind of prejudice they can to achieve their ends. And you can see that in the alliance building. You know, I don't think Charles Koch really believes that undocumented immigrants are stealing elections in America, but he's happy to fund groups that will put out the word that they do in order to incite prejudice to get people to the polls. Similarly, for the, you know, anti-gay groups in the religious right, as she points out, perfectly happy to do what say whatever they have to say to them to make sure they come out to vote to get these guys the power that they want. But she's right. At the end of it, it would be a horror, frankly. I mean, it would make what Charles Dickens was writing about look so mild by comparison. And some of Koch's people, there's a guy named Tyler Cohen at George Mason who co-presides with Charles Koch over their outpost at George Mason called the Mercatus Center. And he's frankly said that America's going to look a lot more like Texas, and the words he uses are get ready. We're going to have much more inequality. He says we're going to have favela-like shanty towns in America because the wage disparity is going to grow so great, but because some people will climb out of poverty, it'll make it easier to ignore those who remain there. So I 100% agree with Anne. I think this is a nightmare vision, and it's a messianic vision by someone who has an ungodly amount of money, I could say, to enact that messianic vision, and it would make it for an utterly unsustainable society. But the frightening thing is they have the power and the resources, and they've built the institutional apparatus to be very close to pulling this off.
Let's take another call. Here's Daniel in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nancy McLean.
Yeah, hi, Jeffrey, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, hi, Nancy, thanks so much. What I'm listening to is a whole bunch that sounds so much like Ayn Rand and objectivism, and I wanted to know if she shows up in any way as a contributor to this radical philosophy. Then the second question is, when we shine such a clear light on this totally untenable position that we all may be created equal, but we no longer deserve to be treated equal, wow. I mean, that just splits the divide, makes it so clear. And I can't imagine that many of us, when we see it that way, would say, sure enough, I think people need to be treated unequally. For instance, the Trump budget and then the Republican health care plan, those definitely they're sure slanted. So anyway, I don't have a solution, but I'd love to see that conversation with Bright Light put on it that all people do, in fact, really deserve to be treated equally.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate that. So your thoughts, Nancy?
Yeah, great questions. And Ayn Rand, I don't have Buchanan talking. You know, I've never seen him talking about her, but the young men, and only men were admitted to the University of Virginia for the founding years of this, more than the first decade of this program. Women weren't admitted until 1970. So it was a very country clubby school, and it was entirely white men who joined this program. And many of them came in because they had been reading Ayn Rand, you know, who was publishing and gaining popularity in those years. And like Ayn Rand, they would actually wear their dollar sign, you know, pins and tie pins and stuff. So you're absolutely right that she's important. And apparently there's a big picture of Ayn Rand in the Cato Institute that, you know, is founded by Charles Koch. So yeah, there's a person who's written about her who's used the phrase gateway drug, you know, that there's so many people who came into this enterprise from being thrilled by the writings of Ayn Rand. So she's very important in kind of early recruitment. And I'm glad that you talk about, you know, sort of what happens when you shine a bright light on this and how it splits the difference. And I think you're so right. And that is my hope with this book, is that for a long time, time, you know, we've been kind of locked into these positions that don't really correspond to who we are. You know, so we hear that the American public is split between liberals and conservatives, between pro-market and pro-government, and so forth and so on. And these Koch operations have really tried to gin up this kind of toxicity we're seeing in our public life now, and, you know, making, you know, say conservatives believe that liberals hate them and look down on them and all of that stuff. And I don't actually think that's the reality. I think, you know, as E.J. Dionne, you know, brilliantly pointed out years ago in his book, Why Americans Hate Politics, most Americans are kind of more centrist. You know, we think that people should take responsibility for themselves, but we think there should also be a government safety net there, you know, to protect them when things go awry, as they inevitably do. There are certain common purposes that we believe in. You know, we want people to have security in their old age, so we have Social Security. We believe people should have health care, so we have Medicare and Medicaid. And as you say, that Trump budget it's the billionaires' budget. You know, it's the donor. It's what the donors want, not the people want. You know, ordinary Republican voters are good people, just like ordinary Democratic voters are good people, or ordinary independents. And the majority on all these things wants to see people have health care that protects them if they have a pre-existing condition. You know, they want to see action to keep our air and water clean. They want to invest in our future with good public schools and access to education. You know, I could just go on and on. And the crucial thing for Republicans to understand, and I wrote that book, you know, in hopes of reaching out. My dad was a lifelong Republican, so, you know, I want to talk to Republicans. The crucial thing for people to realize is it's almost like their party's been inhabited and taken over by this donor network, such that Republican elected officials are at odds with what their own voters want. And they're pushing through this minoritarian agenda, and it's time for all of us, as you say, you know, to split the divide and to start shining a bright light on what's happening and reopen conversations with one another about the kind of society we want to have and give to our children and what we need to do to ensure that we're able to do that.
So, Nancy, we just have a little more than a minute left, and I just want to know how much you think the left contributes to its own demise, either through poor organizing or poor messaging or lavish compensation packages for public employees or any of that.
Yes. So there are definite issues that people on the left have to address and definite problems. I will say, though, right now, I think one thing that's happened is that people don't understand where all this is coming from. They understand that something is radically changing their society and government. They understand that the Republican Party has been doing things that no major political party has ever done before in our history, like the degree to which they filibustered Obama. They wouldn't let him seat a Supreme Court justice. So I think everybody's going a little bonkers right now, you know, and that's not a good thing. That's a dangerous thing. I think we all need to take a deep breath, think hard, understand where this is coming from, talk, and then talk to one another about what to do about it. But yes, we all need to be thinking harder and acting smarter.
History and politics and a whole lot of research went into this book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. You'll learn a lot about James McGill Buchanan, and obviously a bit about the author, too, who joined us today, Nancy McLean at the Duke University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
All right, take care. And that'll do it.